I'm digging my grave. I'm digging my grave. My road to hell is surely paved with all the love that I never gave.
It was hot August 1838, right in the heart of the humid Missouri sprawl. Unusually hot that summer. Not even the wells were cold.
The local townsfolk, who had spent the last handful of years carving out the dark, rich frontier soil and turning it into the upstart community of Gallatin, donned their Sunday best as the sweat dripped through their heavy cotton shirts.
Missouri was rising as fast as the heat that day. The area was exploding with settler growth, the land said to be some of the best on the continent. Its banks and bottoms lined with the finest timber, the ground able to grow anything dropped into the soil. The small settlement of Gallatin had a year earlier pushed out the remaining Sac, Fox, and Potawatomi tribes and removed them to present-day Kansas to make room for white encroachment. And encroach they did. Settlers rushed to the area, and no one came faster than the Mormons.
By 1838, some estimates had Mormons clocked at 15,000 people. The majority of those were starting to pour into the Missouri frontier. Davis County was newly formed, and the excitement was palpable as they held their first ever election for local and state leadership under the sweltering August heat.
Was it the heat or the hate that day that led to the sound of screams and blood and timbered oak hearts cracking against skulls?
This July ground is mighty hard. My back is broken, my hands are scarred.
First, something a little less dangerous to your skull, a word from our friends at Signature Books. Without question, Mormonism's most influential scholar during the first half of the 20th century was B.H. Roberts, historian, theologian, public intellectual, and member of the First Council of 70. Outside of his official church duties and his passion for research and writing, Roberts was an active figure in partisan politics, having run for Congress twice, elected once, but due to opposition from both political parties over polygamy, was never seated. This biography, by prize-winning historian and friend of the podcast, John Sillitoe, the fullest and most scholarly assessment to date of the controversial church leader, examines Roberts' entire life, with particular attention to the public figure who remains influential even today. Born in England to LDS convert parents, Robert served as a missionary, and several years after his call as a general authority, at age 60, began serving as a chaplain during World War I. From 1922 to 1927, he presided over the church's Eastern States mission. Although a hero to many even today for his scholarly output, a feat still rare among those called to church leadership, modern assessments recognize antiquated views on race and women's suffrage. Yet Roberts remains a deeply compelling figure worthy of study. B.H. Roberts, A Life in the Public Arena by John Sillitoe, published by Signature Books. Get it at Benchmark Books, unless you want Lyman White whacking you in the head with an oak heart.
Damn it, Brian, you really messed up my intro. It was dramatic, resolute, violent, but with a dash of pathos. We were being serious. I was just getting theatrical. And you interrupted with B.H. Roberts? I mean, it's a great book and people should buy it because B.H. Roberts had a weird and wacky life, but we already skipped over Missouri and I was bringing us back. No, not to Nauvoo, but to Missouri. You'd think B.H. Roberts would appreciate a comprehensive history of the church like that.
Wasn't that the Justin Timberlake song, I'm Bringing Missouri Back? It was a crappy song. I know. Guys, we breezed over the Missouri period in Mormon history. Doo-doo-doo, Jackson County, la-dee-da, far west, and then we were done with it. But don't worry, we return to Jackson County all the time, just like the scriptures say. Yes, it's in a horseshoe pattern, calm down. Don't fret, Sister Park, Brother B.H., you should be pleased to know, we're returning to Missouri for an appropriately apocalyptic scene, a classic example of large-scale violence involving Mormons and mobs. We're talking about the Gallatin Election Riot of 1838.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Let's get back into this headspace. Let's set the scene. Everyone put your somber, sober hats on for a minute. Get your persecution hat ready for when we're finished. But for now, place on your somber hat, put it on your noggins, bow your head, close your eyes, and hold in your minds an unusually hot and humid day in August, Missouri, 1838. The air is thick with sweat and violence. And let's just say this, whiskey abounds in the culture at that time. That cannot be overstated. It was in the homes and fields and politics of the frontier, and Gallatin was no different. Several of the candidates drank as they stumped for their vote, as nearly 200 white men gathered in the small town at the home of Major Joseph McGee, an older gentleman who portioned part of his small home as a tailor shop.
Oh, I remember this story. There was that whole thing with the dress, and he made it for her, and then she wrote, "Only bought this dress so you could take it off."
Wrong tailor, buddy, but nice reference. Nice job. No, this tailor, McGee, allowed the townsmen to arrive at his small framed house about 12 by 14 feet in size on the southwest part of the Gallatin town square.
So picture the scene here. It's a new town square with a few small wooden homes. Men like William Penniston, who was running for a position in the state legislature, stood on some wooden barrels and sipped whiskey from a flask as he made his case. His most compelling campaign argument centered around a common and growing enemy, Mormons. Ah, William Penniston. Do you know what his nickname was in town? Well, you know what? It's not important. Moving on.
Mormons were gaining power, prominence, and seriously threatened to elect their own people. Not Gentiles like old Billy Penniston, who stood angrily on the whiskey stump with his own whiskey, angrily calling Mormons goddamn liars and horse thieves.
Now that is a catchy campaign button.
Penniston knew that the Mormon numbers threatened his own campaign, and he tried one last Election Day pitch to persuade people to vote for him. So his strategy was to preach about the fraudulent practices of counterfeiting, healing the sick, and other supposed miracles from the Mormon leader Joseph Smith, who Penniston yelled loudly was scamming the people.
Missouri, at this point, is a slave state, and a lot of these Mormons moving into the area were sympathetic to the abolitionist cause. What with their New England fancy-pants East Coast ways. The cause of democracy in America, remember, is still fragile and new. It's just a few decades old, and many of the prominent elderly citizens remembered actually fighting for the continent against tyranny. There's an insecurity in the public mind about what this new freedom meant. They were feeling it out together, but there's one thing many men in Missouri believed in, that white men were entitled to these newly won rights, and black men and others were not.
So Penniston relied on these fears in his speech, comparing Mormons, more than once, to black men, though he used a different word, we'll just say. He said that Mormons shouldn't be permitted to vote and ruin the cause of suffrage, because they were unstable religious con men and fools who wanted religious tyranny. They saw the communal ways similar to religious conservatives being afraid of communism and socialism today, and Mormons seemed to threaten that idea of democracy. Maybe it was all their communal living? I don't know. Or voting in block, or secret polygamy. We're not there yet.
Starts with C-O-M-M. It's bad. Just leave it at that.
Penniston concluded his remarks with this powerful warning, quote, "If we suffer men like those to vote, you will lose your suffrage."
Glug, 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 Billy. So, honestly, that's a pretty good mic drop line there. But the real mic drop, of course, is opening the whiskey barrel he was mounted on and passing out the liquor to his supporters. Good times, those elections.
I love this story because we like to think this is a thing of the olden days, but I've heard about this happening in current elections because American elections now are wild, wild west times. Politicians in western states, we won't say which one, who are so sloshed for the session that they have to be held up by their aides. The wild is still west, my friends. And it's the American frontier values of your God-given right to be a hot, hot mess while representing your constituents.
Maybe it was the heat. Maybe it was the fiery rhetoric and the whiskey in their veins. Either way, this is not a good recipe for kumbaya and a square dance.
How about a steak dance, then? Because that's what happens next. And by steak dance, I don't mean the kind where 14-year-old boys from Murray 19th take the sweaty palms of their partners into the rhythmic bliss tones of Lady in Red.
Fun fact, did you know Krista Berg got his second anointing just for that song?
Nice try. No, by steak dance, I mean a bunch of drunk and angry men starting to pick up wooden stakes to beat the ever-living shiz out of each other.
A sweet little Mormon preacher by the name of Samuel Brown, not that Samuel Brown, was just there to cast his vote when a drunken, excited Gentile by the name of Richard Weldon confronted him and said, Are you a Mormon preacher?
And of course, the Mormon guy was proud and like, yes, sir, of course I am. Weldon said, do you believe in miracles and healing the sick? And Sam Brown gets all excited and was like, yes, of course we do. This is a missionary moment. And Weldon doesn't like this at all, tells him he's being scammed, and then starts beating the little Mormon preacher into a pulp. So another Mormon man named Hiram Nelson tries to pull Weldon off of Brown, and he gets jumped by a dozen Mormon.
Hold on, you're telling me a guy named Hiram Nelson was Mormon? I'm not buying that for 2 seconds.
Riley Stewart, also a Mormon, looks around and notices that near this little cute little tailor shop voting shed is a shingle machine with a bunch of hollowed out oak stakes just sitting there. Heavy, almost the size of baseball bats. Heaven sent. So he picks up one and cracks it over the back of Weldon's skull. It's split open, Weldon falls to the ground, and as John D. Lee described it so poetically, the fight became general.
I'm sure he had no interest in jumping in and participating, being John D. Lee. Now, you have to remember, it's only a month earlier that Samson Avard and a bunch of Mormon toughs, and that's toughs with 2 F's, pal, started forming the Danites. They had their accompanying signs and tokens that they would use to call one another to battle. You know, like this day. Someone in the crowd apparently called the Danites using one of those symbols, and the Mormon guys who were familiar with the call stepped right in. Dudes like, big surprise, John D. Lee, John L. Butler, and Lyman White. All these guys took up the call, and men everywhere grabbed whatever weapons they could find. Mostly, it was these oak carts from the shingle machine that were sitting there. Some guys had knives, some of them used stakes, some of them had clubs, whatever they could grab. If you ever played River City Ransom as a kid, and your calling election is made sure if you did, it was kind of like that situation. Several men were left for and assumed dead. It would be forever known as Whacking Day.
And the Lord said, whack ye all the serpents which crawl on their bellies, and thy town shall be a beacon unto others. So you see, Lisa, even God himself endorses Whacking Day.
So it's one of those toughs that we plan to focus on today, Lyman White. Because not only was he there that day in the heart of all the Oakheart action, but he and Joseph Smith Jr. would respond to the Gallatin fracas by organizing an armed group of Mormons and ride to the homes of prominent judges and sheriff's houses, asking what they intended to do about the violence. Mormons had heard rumors that Judge Adam Black was organizing a mob to kill Mormons, so Joseph Smith and Lyman White thought it would be a good idea to organize a mob first. They rode out to the judge's house. They were ominous and threatening enough that Judge Black would file charges, and others did too, issuing complaints that Smith and White tried to strong-arm prominent citizens into Mormon compliance. And that's how we'll start the Lyman White story today.
Hang down your head now, what have you done? Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head now, what have you done?
Speaking of whiskey,
Lyman White, we said we'd get to him, didn't we? We, at the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast, we keep our promises. A Lannister always pays their debts. And no, I didn't have to Google this reference, I promise. Lyman White, part 2 of our Mormon Renegade special going on right now. Wait, how does the promotion work again? You listen to James Emmett, you give him your wife, and then you get Lyman White for the low, low price of 3 Zodiacs?
Something like that, but I think you lose your shoes no matter what happens.
Dang it, I like my shoes. I mean, my flip-flops. I'm being honest here.
It is February, after all.
Because, you know, just like James Emmett from last episode, Lyman White goes off the rails in a way that would make baby Joseph Smith cry. If baby Joseph Smith were still alive to see it, that is. That was not very nice. Like James Emmett, Lyman becomes another casualty in the Indian Mission Revelation Promises situation, where Joseph Smith gave nebulous instruction to someone about heading into the West to find a place to settle and convert the Lamanites. But then after Joseph Smith dies, no one knows what the hell he meant.
So who is this Lyman White guy? If you're like me, a Brighamite that grew up on the Wasatch Front, where the real Mormons ended up, unless you're a Brannanite or a Josephite or a Strangite or Amidite or best of all a Benimiite, you have never heard of Lyman White. He didn't make it to the GSL, so why do we care? Well, you should care, kids, because he's one of those squishy folks that would have, should have, could have made it into our succession crisis episode.
Lyman White was a rough-and-tumble frontiersman. He'd fought hard in the War of 1812. While Joseph Smith's off whining about, "Oh, my leg hurts," Lyman White is out there kicking some serious British butt. He was also one of those dudes that converted into the Sidney Rigdon Campbellite Baptist congregation. Then he became one of those dirty hippies that lived on the Morley farm in the Kirtland area, trying to be some sort of communist and piss off Saturday's warrior Ezra Taft Benson.
Do we know that they were dirty hippies? Like, Brigham Young was definitely a dirty hippie, because he didn't shower, but...
I would like to return to my common point that everyone was dirty at that point. Brigham was just dirtier.
With all the rickets. Back to business. So, Lyman White didn't just join Sidney Rigdon's congregation. He was, like, super into the congregation. So much so that he started his own Sidney Rigdon franchise, styled The Family. Very original. He got eight others in his little group, and they attempted to live the sort of common stock idea and wait for the millennium to come. And you know what's crazy, Brian? Jesus actually did show up after that. Just shortly after that, just as they had predicted. But Jesus, in this case, came in the form of Mormon missionaries.
Good, because I was thinking for a minute with all this family talk that maybe Charlie Manson was coming to town.
That's Elder Charlie.
Elder Charles P. Manson to you. Now, this is when Mormon elder Parley P. Pratt, there's the P though, shows up to all these little separatist communities with his exotic-sounding Book of Mormon. And Lyman White loved everything about it. He joins Mormonism, along with about 130 other separatists in 1830, after Oliver Cowdery baptized him, and then moved up the ranks with Joseph Smith pretty quickly. And remember, this is part of that whole episode where about 1,000 people from Rigdon's congregation come over. White was part of that. His connection with Rigdon helped get him on top of Joseph Smith's nice list.
And you know he's a big deal when he gets mentioned in Mormon scripture more than once. Every Mormon woman ever is thinking, geez, what would it be like to make it there the first time? But White makes an appearance in the Doctrine and Covenants in section 52, 103, and 124. Here's the classic line from 52, quote, "Let my servant Lyman White beware, for Satan does..." Oh, I gotta try my God voice again. Quote, "Let my servant Lyman White..." What does the God sound like? More Elizabeth Holmes. "Let my servant Lyman White beware, for Satan desireth to sift him as chaff." And not only his only claim to Mormon fame, he did several stints of prison time with the prophet Joseph himself. And it really starts with this whole nonsense in the Gallatin election skirmish. Cracking skulls will do that for you.
Lyman did the classic Mormon tour, Kirtland to Missouri. All of the hits, nothing from the new album. When the church is only 4 years old, the Saints, remember, are being kicked out of Missouri, and Lyman White helped lead the rescue mission. He was in the thick of this Missouri mob shenanigans. He helps organize the Camp of Israel, he and Sidney Rigdon going among the Mormons in Ohio to recruit for this army. He then went with Hiram Smith up to Michigan to grab a few more Mormons there. Then they joined the march toward the tail end.
And here we have to play Mormon tribulation time for a second. When Lyman and his last crew of stragglers arrive at Zion's camp to help Joseph march and build up an army of 500, they wouldn't even get to half capacity, by the way. Everyone was whining and complaining and fighting a lot. Hiram and Lyman missed out on all the infighting, but they showed up just in time for the cholera outbreak. That ends up afflicting 65 of them and killing 15. Wah, wah. And of course, Joseph Smith takes this opportunity to blame it on their wickedness, even though he and Hiram both got sick too. And I bring this up mostly because you know how we love to talk about cholera on this podcast, but also because, hey, listen, you need to understand how Lyman White gets in the thick of it. He's there for all of this, the suffering, the violence, this persecution. It's up close and personal.
Now, just out of curiosity, do you know how to check for cholera?
No. When you've got nausea, heartburn, indigestion, upset stomach, diarrhea. Speaking of militias, and I want to read a quote from Mel Johnson's biography about Lyman White because this shows something interesting here about the messiness of it all. Plus, pay extra attention to the fun parts about secret code names for the Cool Kids Treehouse Club. Here's what Mel writes, quote, "The leadership, including Lyman White, had begun to plan as early as 1834 to forcefully resist if their enemies came against them again. An irregular paramilitary force with as many as 1,000 males ages 14 and over was organized. Joseph Smith in his secret rank of Barack Ale commanded the church's armed forces. He confirmed White, supposedly in the presence of an angel, to the office of Benimi, a senior leader of the Holy Army. These Danites included several of White's future Texas followers, including Truman Brace and Joel S. Miles. White's religious and civic duties to church and state became confused. While he commanded the Mormon forces at Adirondack and served as President John Smith's counselor in the state presidency there, he was also the colonel commanding the organized 56th Regiment of Missouri Militia. Muddling further his ecclesiastic and secular duties, White ordained Joseph Smith into the Danites. Thus, White commanded both the Missouri and Mormon armed forces of this region," end quote.
For a guy that started his religious journey trying to live communally like a hippie, Lyman really does start going war hungry. John D. Lee and other militia guys at the time talk about how violent Lyman's rhetoric gets. And if John D. Lee thinks your rhetoric is violent, that is a very bad sign.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was like projection or like admiration.
Wish I could be as hawkish as that guy.
One writer did say of Lyman White that, quote, "he itched for combat."
Brigham Young itched for other reasons. Lyman would end up serving a few missions to Jackson County and other parts of Missouri. This leads to him settling down and buying some land there. I've been there. It's actually really cool. It's very
in Adirondack.
It's a very beautiful place. It really is. It's what is interesting though is you go there thinking, "Wow, this is going to be really, I don't know, impressive."
Garden of Eden-y,
and
like
it is
with
beautiful,
a tiger.
But there is literally nothing there, other than Adam's altar that constantly gets the rocks replenished. That's about it. So in 1837, he joins the trend of white settlers moving into this area, settles in Caldwell County, and he's elected colonel of the county militia.
So remember, at this time, militias were the ways towns and counties protected themselves from indigenous resistance and from frontier political struggles and problems in the community. Militias weren't just a Mormon affair. Although, Lyman's leadership here suggests that Mormons would have led the Caldwell County Militia, which is important.
White is living in Missouri. He owns a lot of new land in Gallatin when the election that goes down there. When the mobs came, he gets very hardcore about it. He was known for this colloquial phrase, "Pray for our enemies that God would damn them and give us power to kill them."
Oh my gosh, Lyman White has so many good phrases. My favorite Lyman White phrase is, "Boys, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we fight." Can someone please, please, please out there send that to me in a vinyl sign for my dining room? Because I'd like to open all my FHEs that way, please.
I have to think Lyman White is the kid when they read the part in the Book of Mormon where they slept on their swords so they could fight in the morning. He was like, "Can we read that again like 12 more times?"
He's super into it.
I really like that part. Now, you remember, kids, as Jesus said in the Doctrine and Covenants 105, "I will fight your battles, but not Lyman White's." Something like that.
Who doesn't love a good wartime Jesus, right? Lyman White does. John D. Lee does. Hosea Stout does. All those Mormon elders.
Willard Richards loves that.
Okay, back to business. In 1837, Lyman moved to Adirondack, and John D. Lee writes it as Adirondack, which I love. Adirondack. It's perfect spelling.
Wasn't that one of David Bowie's characters?
Adirondack, yeah. And it's interesting when you read these early journal accounts of how Mormons viewed these areas in Missouri, because you said it's beautiful. Well, at the time, apparently the soil really was rich and the land was great. And you can see why these frontier men saw it as a Garden of Eden, because everybody wanted this land. Apparently it was really like choice farming land. But anyway, Lyman joins the stake presidency in Adirondack in 1838 and becomes a prominent Danite.
To see how the Mormons radicalized from the Campbellite hippie socialists to radical Missouri toughs, you just have to follow Lyman's story. I've been told that last month's issue of The Friend had a dot-to-dot on how to radicalize a religious minority in just a few years, and at the end it's just Lyman White's face.
And Ammon Bundy has it under his mattress.
Candidate Ammon Bundy? Is that who you meant?
Potential governor. Show some respect.
My hand is raised as someone who owns an Ammon Bundy campaign t-shirt. Thank you, benefactor.
Not so fast, though, Brian, because while Lyman was radicalizing, it wasn't always in the direction of loyalty to the Mormon leaders. Listen to what Susan the Easton Black has to say, quote, Lyman was just as bold in declaring doctrine that was not doctrine of Jesus Christ. A church judicial proceeding was held on August 21st, 1834 to investigate his pronouncement that, quote, all disease in this church is of the devil, and that medicine administered to the sick is of the devil, for the sick in the church ought to live by faith. Another judicial proceeding was held on April 24th, 1837 to investigate Lyman's teaching that, quote, the church was under a celestial law because God does not whip in a celestial, and that the Book of Covenants and Doctrine was a celestial law and the Book of Commandments was a celestial law. In both cases, Lyman apologized for his misunderstanding of doctrine and was forgiven, but more than one saint believed, quote, Lyman White as a bull in the net is in danger of apostasy, but the prophet holds on to him.
The fact that his biography was Wild Ram of the Mountains, not Bull in the Net, really a lost opportunity.
Misquoted there.
Okay, yeah. White had doctrinal disagreements. He got a little too rowdy with his fists sometimes, but these are the early days of Mormonism. The stick pulling, the leg wrestling days. Joseph really kind of liked a little spunk in his apostles. Not like Lou Grant.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well, yeah.
I hate spunk.
One thing Lyman was good at doing was not just getting in trouble at church, but in trouble with the law also. When he was serving in the stake presidency in the Adamondi-Ammon stake, he was taken into custody by the Missouri State Militia and charged with murder and treason.
And as a Mormon, I'm offended that any army can just walk into the Garden of Eden like that and arrest anyone sitting on the councils of paradise. I'm pulling my religious persecution card, putting my hat on, because when I think of the Garden of Eden, I just have to say, yet again, I want tigers, Brian. The Sunday school pictures promise tigers. If Carol Baskin isn't mad about it, then it's not paradise. See? See that right there? I'm pulling the religious persecution card, putting it on the table, and I'll raise you a Joe Exotic side-eye.
I will suggest keeping that card in your vest pocket for now, because you might need it later. Actually, you're going to need it, like, a lot for this episode. But first, Missouri will play their hand. Missouri General Moses Wilson tried to get Lyman White to swear an affidavit against Joseph Smith, allegedly threatening Lyman's life if he refused. Lyman replied, quote, Joseph Smith is not an enemy to mankind. He is not your enemy and is as good a friend as you have got. Had it not been for him, you would have been in hell long ago, for I should have sent you there by cutting your throat, and no other man but Joseph Smith could have prevented me, and you may thank him for your life.
He's really articulate with the violence. He paints in violence like Picasso does with acrylic. It's beautiful.
I think he actually painted with his knife, didn't he?
Knife painting, it's a thing. I'm going to go back to Susan Easton Black for a minute because she really captures this reminiscence pretty heroically. She claims that General Wilson responded to all of this by saying, quote, White, you are a strange man, but if you will not accept my proposal, you will be shot tomorrow morning at 8. Lyman replied, shoot and be damned.
I feel like these guys would have run out of gloves like slapping each other for duels. They're like, ah, gee, I'm out of gloves, man.
It's like spitting in a spittoon at this point. Lyman's life was spared, but not from imprisonment. Lyman was incarcerated in Independence, Richmond, and Liberty jails. So yeah, he did a lot of prison time with the prophet. And what's that you're always saying about peeing in a bucket together, Brian?
Oh no, it actually comes from Deuteronomy. He that will not pee with the anointed one in the bucket, verily, he is the one that can suck it.
That honestly sounds like something you just picked up at scout camp.
I'm not going to sit here and pretend like our cheer wasn't Troop 33, we gotta go pee.
Well, at girls' camp, there was no peeing in buckets because we peed in Aunt Piggy's privy like a lady.
So it's in some of these jail time escapades that some apocryphal Mormon lore is born, with Lyman White front and center. Remember the infamous story of Joseph Smith being fed human flesh in jail? That's a Lyman White original right there.
Which child amongst us in Mormonism hasn't sat down in primary on a Sunday while eating our Cheerios and popcorn, hearing about eating human flesh?
See, this is so funny. This is one of those things, like, clearly you heard this all the time. I never heard this.
How did you not? I heard this all the time.
Lindsay, there's more than one way to Mormon.
Fair enough. In his book about Lyman White, historian Melvin C. Johnson writes, quote, Joseph Smith, Lyman White, and others remained in jail for several months, suffering several hardships at the hands of their captors. The quality of food was rank and its origin at times suspect. One guard at dinner time supposedly asked White how he liked, quote, Mormon beef, the implication that the prisoners were eating human flesh. The suggestion reflects the hatred that continued to burn for several generations between Mormons and Missourians. Ew, Mormon beef. I hate it said like that.
Yeah, it's like Heber's jerky, only fresher.
Gross.
I mean, it's a great quote, but don't forget the other interesting succession crisis tidbit, because Lyman White also gets tied up in some Joseph Smith III claims. He later argued that he had helped when Joseph Smith ordained his young son to be his, quote, successor when I depart. Many years later, a woman named Rebecca Ballantyne swore an affidavit that White had basically told her the same story. Joseph Smith III would also claim that the ordination happened during the Liberty Jail period. And, obviously, this question of how succession worked, along with polygamy, would be the main issues between the LDS and RLDS factions down the road.
Yep, one minute you're peeing in buckets together, and the next you're settling your prophetic last will and testament.
So yeah, there's lots of jail time, lots of prophetic pee buckets, lots of mobbing, and of course, the Gallatin conflict that bled into, quite literally, the Mormon conflicts in Missouri. Once we reach the Nauvoo period, Lyman is ordained an apostle in 1841, then a Council of 50 member, and also member of the Anointed Quorum in 1844. But this means, although Lyman White is a junior member of the 12, he's a senior member of the Council of 50 and outranks just about everybody, including Brigham Young. How did he outrank fellow apostles in the Council of 50? Well, because he was older. If you remember, like the original Council of the 12 was structured in 1835, the Council of 50 was ordered by age.
If you'll remember, Lyman also spent a lot of time in Wisconsin clearing timber for the Nauvoo Temple construction. And this is where he supposedly gets an itching to preach to the Lamanites in Texas. I know, that's a lot. Going from Wisconsin to Texas. Did we mention he also becomes a polygamist? At least four times. It's actually a pretty long story. And one I'm going to let the work of historian Mel Johnson explain. We originally had Mel Johnson coming on the podcast, but he's had some health problems, so we're just going to pull heavily from his book and send all of our thoughts and wishes to Mel Johnson and his family as he recovers from surgery.
So White goes to Wisconsin. He's sent up there to find lumber to build the Nauvoo Temple. While he's there, he learns more about the resources that are available on the frontier. There is a growing housing shortage in Nauvoo, as well as the edges of the United States everywhere. So his job is to find more resources.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we've mentioned this before, but because of the housing shortage in 1841, everybody knows about the housing shortage of 1841, right? Joseph Smith organizes the Nauvoo House Association and the Temple Committee. And the idea is to get all these new immigrants that are coming to gather in Nauvoo, that he's going to give them jobs by building the temple, public works, buildings, and the Nauvoo House. And as part of that, they send Lyman White, Bishop George Miller of the Pineries, and Alpheus Cutler and Peter Hawes to Wisconsin. But the question of Texas is interesting. And we've teased it a few times about the Mormons going to Texas or potentially going to Texas, but why Texas, Brian?
Historians like Douglas Larch and Michael Van Wagenen have looked at this Texas idea in light of Joseph Smith's presidential campaign. Van Wagenen notes that the Texas project represented three ways to get around all of these mounting problems in Nauvoo. First, in his presidential platform, Joseph Smith suggested they just annex Texas. Second, they were also trying to get approval from Congress to create this massive army to protect Texas as well as Oregon. This is the one, remember, where we're like, they had to have gotten a good laugh out of this. 100,000 dudes. Come on, man. Finally, maybe the Mormons could just buy some land in lesser populated, but in hot demand, parts of Texas. Van Wagenen argued, quote, Smith planned to establish a theocratic nation that would serve as a buffer between Texas and Mexico. In this new kingdom of God, Smith and his followers would be free to practice their peculiar religious beliefs from the interference of the United States.
Okay, but back to the pineries for a minute, because when George Miller was up in Timberland trying to get wood for Heavenly Father, yes, I wrote it like that on purpose, things weren't going so well. Men were overworked and underpaid and disenchanted. But then Lyman White shows up and turns things all around. His common stock ideas really pay off here, and he organizes the group in a way where more people are eating. And it starts working, but then the crabs in a bucket situation happens, and White's success threatens Miller's reputation. So Brother Bishop George Miller starts to get a little jealous, and he starts talking some shiz about Lyman White, and it gets salty and gossipy.
George Miller knew that Lyman White had a not-so-secret addiction to the sauce. No, not fry sauce. The whiskey fry sauce. Lyman was a bit of an alky. Apparently his drinking had been a public problem for years, and by now it was affecting his appearance and weight. George Miller fat-shamed White, saying, quote, In consequence of his indulgence in a habit that he was occasionally addicted to, his face and body were very much bloated or swollen.
Okay, George Miller, this is why all the Danites want to do murdery things to you. You don't talk about your bros that way, dude. But yeah, Lyman White's communal order changed things around for the community in the pineries, and even though Miller wasn't a fan of White's ideas, other people seemed to appreciate the help. And by help, it looks like the community would still struggle financially, but hey, at least they'd struggle together. Records show that their first real winter together as a community was raked by hunger. One kid says that he found a biscuit that he ate, found a biscuit in a rat's nest, and he asked his mom about it, and she was like, I don't think you should eat that. But then he cried, and she's like, okay, eat the rat's nest biscuit. And this other guy cooked an ox that was dead for 3 weeks for the group. So nice job, Lyman.
Called the Sago Lily Principle. Look it up. And you think this stuff was bad? Well, the Mormon issues on Indian land would strike again. As the group recovered from the terrible winter, the local Indian agent in the area gets real pissed at the Mormons timbering on Indian land without permission in 1843. It got so bad with the local tribes and the agents that Mormons in the area wrote to Joseph Smith for permission to head to Texas to be able to set up a gathering. To be able to set up a gathering place for the saints there. And at that particular time, this was kind of music to Joseph Smith's ears because things were not going so great in Nauvoo. He thought exploring Texas sounded like a fine idea.
So, like we mentioned before, in March of 1844, the Council of 50 sent Lucian Woodworth to negotiate with Sam Houston to get some of that sweet land in the Republic of Texas, which isn't part of the United States just yet. So, White and Miller go back to Nauvoo to counsel about all of this, and this is where they are led into the fancy Council of 50. And it's there that Lyman is ordained to go on a mission to Texas, and George Miller is sent to Kentucky.
So, we could say they sent Lucian to see how much their wood's worth. All right.
Here's I've got Brian quoting Taylor Swift now. It's fantastic.
I'm part of the game now. I'm part of the solution. So here's where things get a little bit tricky, because according to Lyman White, Joseph Smith set him apart to lead the saints to Texas like Moses, bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. He also claims that Joseph Smith gave him a white seer stone. I believe all of that is in the director's cut of Ten Commandments.
And when it comes to priesthood claims, that's basically what you need to know. Lyman claims he was ordained to be like Moses. And then later in a meeting where Joseph counsels Lyman before he leaves to Texas, and Heber Kimball is there, apparently the meeting is a little more anticlimactic, because Heber doesn't remember it in the same way and would eventually reject Lyman's claims. And the other witness to the event was Joseph Smith, and he would die shortly thereafter. So I guess we have to take Lyman's word for it.
I was a highwayman, along the coach roads I did ride, with a sword and pistol by my side.
That would actually be kind of a good book, taking their word for it, The Secret Joseph Smith Missions. There were a few of those. Well, all those events in Carthage that culminated in the death of Joseph and Hiram Smith also manifested as stress in the community. That summer, George Miller and a few others tried to get the Council of 50 to reorganize the church, but got shot down. Lyman White and George Miller weren't weathering the storm. Miller was mad that White wasn't following his authority politics and wasn't at first backing the 50 over the 12, and White was mad about an old lumber contract that involved a steamboat. It's complicated. We don't really have time for all of it, but you can find more about it in Mel's book.
You know what's funny is how many conflicts that the Mormons had that dealt with steamboats. You just don't see that anymore. Steamboat conflicts in your contracts. The good old days.
I have a maid of Iowa in my backyard.
You better not. Should we call the police? Okay, so you can read about the fight between Miller and White in Mel Johnson's book. The Hancock Chronology, a newspaper at the time, carried a headline on August 4th, 1844, reporting a, quote, fisticuff fight in Nauvoo between Bishop George Miller and Elder Lyman White. I would have loved to see that.
It's tough to come up with a more vintage-sounding word than fisticuffs.
Fisticuff fight between the bishop.
Does this and need to elder. Come to fisticuffs?
Back in their day, you settled things with your fists. So Mel Johnson also gives us this quote. The 12 succession to church leadership did not end contention, as several members of the 50 attempted to continue its prestige and status, rivaling the 12. It's interesting that only the three members of the 12, Johnny Page, William Smith, and Lyman White, who later separated from the church and denied their quorum, had the authority to choose the proper successor to Joseph Smith Jr., were appointed to the Council of 50 after Smith's direction to the 12 early in 1844. In the presence of the 50, that the 12 should govern the church if he were to die. This may have been because the newer members of the 12 had more influence in the 50 than they did in the 12, since Joseph used age to determine ranking in the 50, certain dissenters, including Alpheus Cutler, George Miller, Peter Hawes, Lucian Woodworth, and Lyman White, all ranked ahead of Young and the other apostles. White used this argument with Preston Thomas in 1849, stating because he was older than Young, he was at least his equal, if not his senior, end quote.
White starts to really think that his position as a senior member of the 50 gave him power over the 12, and that just shows how messy this is. Because Lyman at first backs the 12, then doesn't, then rejects his old pal and commune brother, Sidney Rigdon's claims, and by that point, he's just kind of disenchanted with Brigham and the Quorum as a whole. And this is true. White did not like Brigham's use of I instead of we.
Same girl, same.
There's no crying in baseball, and there's no I in Quorum of 12. There is a we, however.
You really did say that. Lyman was pissed about Brigham using I and we wrong.
This does not surprise me. They could get angry about just about anything.
Fisticuffs, even.
Fisticuffs are coming.
All of this stuff is still simmering because by August of 1844, White still follows his charge from the Quorum of the Twelve to prepare for his mission to Texas. At this point, it's less of a charge to go and more of Brigham being go-if-you-wish-to-go situation.
One thing that Mel Johnson brings up that I think is really important is that being in the Quorum in the Council 50 is an important calling, right? It gives you prestige and status, but because Lyman was up in the Pineries for so long, he wasn't down in Nauvoo trauma bonding with the rest of the boys. When Heber, Kimball, and Brigham Young are building a network of wives that link them with other apostles, Lyman White marries a few polygamous wives that aren't really tied to anyone. And because of this, because he doesn't marry within a network, he doesn't have the kinship that link the other Quorum members more closely together. But his marriages connected him to his future followers. His plural wives would be related to a bunch of the families that follow him out to Texas.
160 people follow Lyman White on a steamboat to Texas. See, we're back to steamboats. This steamboat, called General Brooks, started a cursed journey to Texas. People got sick, they died on the boat, and they'd have to winter in several places before making the journey. Sounds like they should have named it the Joanna Brooks for better luck.
Meanwhile, back at the Nauvoo, things aren't going so hot. People are gossiping that they heard Lyman curse the temple before he left. Joseph Fielding recorded that Lyman leaving, quote, has caused some to say that Nauvoo had a mighty puke and is the bad stuff that is thrown up. Ouch, that's salty. So much tea. The real houseboys of Mosquito Creek are saltier than the Great Salt Lake. At one point, William Clayton investigates a claim that Lyman sends a man to Nauvoo to burn down the temple because we can't overstate the lumber shortage. There's issues with the lumber. A large majority of these issues with the whole group has to do with the limited amount of timber. Everyone wants the timber that's been used for the temple. Apparently, some people felt that Lyman wanted the timber back so badly from the Nauvoo Temple that he would send a guy to burn it down, though William Clayton could never substantiate the arson rumors.
This is probably a good time to remind you, when you're sitting in Sunday school, picturing in the Quorum of the Twelve as these sweet old men in red chairs, remember that in 1844 things were a little different. We already told you about the great frontiersman turned frontier cult leader, James Emmett. Lyman White kind of had a similar disposition. As Lyman and his group made their way down to Texas, they'd stay at different settlements along the way and offend everyone there. One person said, quote, White is said to have been a Mormon and a sinner of the most pronounced type, the hardest swearer and freest drinker in the vicinity.
Speaking of lumber shortages, the Mormons who were in the nearby pining communities in Wisconsin and elsewhere were struggling with the shortages and conflicts with the Twelve. So Lyman sends them a letter before leaving to Texas, trying to get them to go down with him. Most didn't, but it did signal that he was no longer listening to the Twelve. And off to Texas, this group goes. Their trek is interesting because it seems to invoke a sort of similar cultural utility that the trick to Utah caused the Brighamites. You've got babies dying and secret...
Don't do that.
I'm sorry, babies dying. Secret plural marriages, hardships, sick oxen, boo, hiss, boo, all of that. And nothing builds a persecution complex, Brian, like what? Sick oxen.
You, always with the oxen. Finally, the Whiteites arrived in Texas just as it's admitted to the Union. They settle in several places there, but by then, they are no longer following the claims of Brigham. Instead, Lyman White has been developing a theology based on this claim that Joseph Smith had sent him to settle Texas. And the Texans that were there were suspicious of Mormons because it's just really in vogue to hate Mormons in all of America at that time. Every time they tried to stir up a mob...
At that time? Because I feel like McKay Coppin says it's all the time. It's in vogue.
I think we decided you were going to keep your persecution card in your pocket.
Sorry, back in the pocket it goes.
Texans there are like, you know what? Actually, these weirdo Mormons just keep building mills and granaries. So, yeah, they're dirty communists, but they keep to themselves. Let's just leave the weirdos alone.
Listen, they might have been weirdo communists, but Lyman White was said to be a real weirdo communist misogynist on top of it. There are several times he remarks about women, and those remarks sort of rival Brigham Young's worst rhetoric about women. And when they weren't doing polygamy, Lyman was arranging marriages for girls in the group. How fun. Here's more from Mel Johnson, quote, Holly's autobiography offers insight into the unusual pattern of Whiteite marriage, including monogamous unions, which these were. The intended mates had little, if any, voice in the choice of their partners. The younger Holly recalled, quote, Father and Lyman made a selection of girls for George and myself and a man for my sister Priscilla. This being the order of the patriarchs, the girl selected for me was a daughter of Oates Hobart, and her name was Harriet. When July the 4th came, I with George and Priscilla was married by Lyman White. Here we began a life of patriarchal orders. Lyman White was very concerned in the creating eternal family units through marriages and adoptions that would last beyond the grave. There's an entire chapter on the gross polygamy shenanigans, a trademark 1850, of the Whiteites. Basically, it's a DiCaprio situation where the grooms grow older and the bride's ages grow younger. So picture all the nonsense that's going on with the Utah polygamy, but this is smaller and more closed in the gene pool with a little bit of Tex-Mex thrown in. So. Thanks, secret polygamy. You leave a great legacy. You're just the gift that keeps on giving.
It wasn't just polygamy, too. Lyman loved the common stock idea and some of the priesthood claims. But what he really loved was the story of Enoch. He would talk about that every chance he got. He also enjoyed dressing like an outlaw. Mel Johnson notes, quote, A Methodist minister described White as a dark-bearded and black-headed man standing over 6 feet, weighing more than 200 pounds. His attire included polished black boots, black broadcloth, a black hat, and holsters for two revolvers strapped around his middle. Sounds like Johnny Cash. Several bodyguards escorted Colonel White whenever he was in public. Black mules pulled the French-style carriage, which always carried a rifle in an attached boot.
Common stock. He uses that word so much. It sounds like what they made store brand Huber's Jerky from.
Never would have hitchhiked to Birmingham if it hadn't been
By now, Lyman had set up a community called Zodiac, Texas. And what's fun is that Bishop George Miller shows up again in 1848 to see his old frenemy Lyman White and to see if he had a good thing going on down there. But I guess he didn't think it was so good because it didn't last long and he leaves shortly thereafter. And remember that Miller and his camp were part of James Emmett's group, referred to last episode, and that didn't end really well with the Quorum. So it didn't help that George Miller said that Brigham Young, compared himself to Joseph Smith and that he felt like that was akin to a toad comparing himself to an ox. Leave the oxen out of this.
Exactly. Don't screw with the oxen. What do you want to do? Piss Lindsay off? Bye now.
There's not enough consecrated oil in this valley to make that remark better again.
That's a Ricketts remark, buddy. That's what that is. By now, there's about 150 people following Lyman White and Zodiac. When Miller shows up, he starts teaching his own version of polygamy to the people. Don't they always? And then he eventually leaves with a handful of people and starts investigating James Strang's claims. But before he left, he published a pamphlet called An Address that disputed Brigham Young's claims. That, of course, pisses off Orson Hyde, who's now in winter quarters, and so he sends Peter Hawes and Lucien Woodworth out to Texas to see what's going on down there.
I love Orson Hyde at this time. He's mad all the time about everything. Orson Hyde's just mad all the time. And again, the Real Houseboys of Mosquito Creek come in with a sass because Orson would write, quote, "Poor Lyman can't keep sober long enough to get on the perfect right track." So Hawes and Woodworth said Lyman's drunkenness was so out of control that he spent $15 a week on liquor, which my inflation calculator claims that is like $582 a week in 2023. That's a lot of money on liquor.
I'm guessing it's probably not real top shelf stuff in the middle of nowhere, Texas, also.
Here's the thing. In the accounts, they say that he would buy the most expensive liquor he could. So
really?
Fancy black carriage, black horse, black holster. Lyman White. Lyman White would drink the best liquor he could find.
In October 1848, at a conference put on by the Potawatomi High Council, White was censored but not cut off from Brigham and his newly formed church. The council then takes a vote to sustain him as an apostle, and they declined. But interestingly, they didn't excommunicate him yet.
Nope, that would happen 2 months later in December of 1848 at the Fort Douglas gathering where the late Joseph Smith Jr.'s uncle, John Smith, who happened to be the oldest and most senior member of the Council of 50, thank you very much, announced the excommunication of Lyman White and George Miller. Amasa Lyman and Brigham Young were there and helped with the decision.
Listen, we could go on and on about this little weird community of Mormons in Texas, but we're kind of running out of time. Zodiac flooded when the Pedernales River overflowed, and the community had to move to a place called Mormon Mill. Now, just a pronunciation note, since we know that angries up the blood. So, Pedernales. The way it's spelled, you'd think it'd be Pedernales, but unless you want to look like an out-of-town lamewad, it's Pedernales.
Look at you looking up things and not saying things wrong this time. So, Lyman's health declined, and he...
Actually, can I tell you a good story about that?
Sure.
You know how I learned the pronunciation of that? I'm doing the mail at work. I'm watching a documentary on Lyndon Johnson, who is from Hill Country, Texas, and they mentioned the Pedernales country. I was like, hey, I know that place.
You know that from Mel Johnson's book.
It was very helpful.
So Lyman's health declined, and he died in 1858 and was buried in Zodiac in his temple robes. And then I think it flooded and it's gone for good. But after his death, his group mostly broke up, with most of his followers joining up with the RLDS Church. Because before his death, White started backing the idea that the real church authority belonged to the children of Joseph Smith. So after he dies, his followers pack up and begin following Joseph Smith III. I guess they abandoned their polygamy too.
This sounds more like an Anyone But Brigham campaign.
Anyone But Brigham. Not Strang, though. Nice work. If it hadn't been, if it hadn't been for
love. If it hadn't been, if it hadn't. So there you have it. Part 2 wrapped up of our Mormon renegades.
Honestly, we should probably throw Bishop George Miller in there too, because there are so many defectors to keep track of. And Miller is fun because, like we mentioned before, I saw a Danite note from Hosea Stout and John D. Lee where they record where Lee swears there's a plot against Miller's life in winter quarters. And the order comes straight from the top. And at this point, the top would be Brigham Young. So Lee claims that he helped tip off Miller before he could be killed. So apparently Lee saved George Miller's life. Wait, is John D. Lee writing that he's a hero of the story? Does he do that often in his own writings?
No. This does not sound authentic.
In any case, these stories are absolutely flavored with murder and bishops and treachery.
I gotta say, bishop murder flavor is kind of my favorite Heber jerky flavor. So smoky and spicy.
Gross.
If you're gonna eat Mormon beef, make sure it's that good Heber kind, not that common stock beef you get at a roadside Costco.
Okay, I'm putting on my persecution hat for the rest of this episode because I'm currently feeling martyred flavor with all this Heber jerky talk. Stop persecuting me, Brian.
Yeah, it's winter quarters time. There's a lot to be persecuted about. There's a lot of treachery. There's a lot of distrust. And it really is because most of these early dudes, the first witnesses of the Book of Mormon, the original organizers, I mean, the Smith family, don't go on to follow Brigham.
We don't talk about this much, but Woodruff stays loyal to Brigham. And Woodruff was a good pal of Lyman White because the two worked really closely in Kirtland. So Wilford Woodruff probably was sad to see Lyman go.
That's a good point. These guys aren't just peeing in buckets together, though they are doing that. They're building together, sweating, bleeding, fighting together. So when the loyal ones, like Lyman White, defect in such a big way, you have to think it caused some distrust among all these men. And that distrust carries into Brigham's leadership.
Here's the thing. This is why you need to get an HBO subscription, Brian, and watch Game of Thrones, because...
What is Game of Thrones?
It's just a little television show. Mormon leaders were so much more Game of Thrones than people realize. We like to think of them as these, like, you know, holy men, but they weren't these pious Quakers promising to hug it out behind the woodshed. Hosea Stout would thug and poison you if you did something they didn't like. But don't you worry, those stories and more are coming up soon enough.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. Well, it's good enough for my grandpa.
Hey, what you want? Baby, I got. What you need? You know I got it. All I'm asking for is a little Books of Mormons report when you come home, powered by Benchmark Books. Friend of the podcast, Mel Johnson, walked the walk. He said, listen, I don't just teach at a college in Texas. I write about Mormon history in Texas. In his fascinating book, Polygamy on the Pardinalis, Lyman White's Mormon Village in Antebellum, Texas, Mel outlines the life of this renegade. He covers all this history we talked about today. And if you think this part that we talked about is fun, wait till you hear more about Zodiac. Yeah, remember, they create a community called Zodiac in the middle of nowhere in Texas. And they build a temple there. That's the first temple west of the Mississippi. Pick it up and get ready for when we're all called to move back to Texas.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. It's good enough for me. I was good enough for Billy Burroughs. I was good enough for Billy Burroughs.
So send avenging angels, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. Won't you send destroying Danites, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let his smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. So gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only
the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.